Attention! Attention! All Area 51 stormers! That means you, Larry. Put down the flamethrower. Before we storm the military's worst-kept secret base, I want you to know that having 500,000 of you here really helps with my anxiety. The 20 guards who can fire 800 rounds a minute with their M16s won't be able to stop us all! Hey, where are y'all going?
The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast brings you the best in East Coast esoterica on the first of every month. Together, we can keep it growing by sharing the show on social media, subscribing to the show wherever you may be listening to it from, and by leaving feedback about your favorite episodes.
Wait! What am I supposed to do with 500,000 egg salad sandwiches?
The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Always available. Always free. Always odd.
It's the odd to Newfoundland. Ghostly greetings from your host, Jonathan. Mysteries, ghosts, monsters, and lore. East Coast esoterica and so much more. If it's up to you, friend, it's on the up to Newfoundland.
Ghostly greetings from the oldest city in North America. I'm your host, John Mallard, bringing you the best in East Coast esoterica. You, my friends, have stumbled upon the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast for the month of November 2019. Welcome to episode 81 of your monthly paranormal variety show. And having you here, well, it's better than getting a trucker to blow his horn back at you on the highway when you do that whole arm up and down thing, you know, the honk honk thing with your arm. Oh, that's so great. Oh, having you here is even better than getting served breakfast in bed. I mean, who would not love to have breakfast in bed right now? It's November. Things are cold. Just snuggle back in your bed and enjoy your delicious breakfast that someone who loves you very much just made you. And why is it so great to have you here? Because having you here is better than that. And why? Because you're wonderful. You're a masterpiece. You're beautifully made. Important to people because you're important to me. Highly favored by your creator. Whether that's God or the law of averages of physics working in tandem, you, my friend, are an oddball. And here on this show, your family and we are one. Welcome. Welcome, one and all. I can't believe I'm going to say this, but this is the second last show of 2019. It's November. Halloween is over. The Halloween hangover is strong in this one. And I have got just an amazing amount of shout outs and thank yous to say on this podcast tonight. So let's just get this ball rolling and started now because there's a lot of people I got to thank a whole bunch. Let's start off number one. Down Home Magazine. Tobias Romanek made a wonderful ad which featured me and, of course, my old pal Dale Jarvis. You might remember Dale, actually, from a previous podcast many, many moons ago. Dale's been on my show, and he's, of course, synonymous with hauntings and ghosts and things like that here in Newfoundland. So it was kind of cool to be featured with him. And in the Down Home Magazine for October, we were both featured in an article about where to find a ghost, where I talked about some of the places I'd investigated as a paranormal investigator. So a big shout-out and thank you to Down Home Magazine. My friends tell me now I now have old man and lady cred because old people like to read that one, apparently. I don't know. I think that was just somebody who was jealous saying that, to be honest. Anyway, I digress. Thank you so very, very much for doing that for me. I certainly appreciate it. Love it. Love articles. And it just started my October off on a great upswing, so to speak. Got to shout out my friend Jerry Russell at the Geek Bar. He had me show up there mid-month in October to do open mic ghost stories. Yeah, that's right. About 40 people showed up to the Geek Bar downtown St. John's, and we told ghost stories for like 2 hours straight. It was so much fun. And then for an hour, we ran the PSP7, the ghost box. Maybe people will know that from Ghost Adventures. We actually ran that device for an hour and just did a little session there because apparently The Geek Bar is quite haunted. There's many, many different paranormal stories that come from there. So in the coming months now, you're probably going to see me put out a bonus episode from that very place, actually, Open Mic Ghost Stories. And you might even get a chance for me to run by some things I might have caught. I think that it would be kind of cool to do a reveal, though, at the Geek Bar itself, and maybe I'll record that if I do manage to find anything. I'll be honest, I just have just been so busy this October, and I have chance even yet to kind of jump into that. I just don't have 10 hours right now, but I'm going to get there. And when I do, you guys will surely know. So thank you, Jerry Russell. Thank you, Geek Bar, and everyone who showed up that event. I'll be sure to tag you all in this episode. You know, it's just so cool. It's just so cool. I can't wait for everyone on the show to hear those ghost stories in the near future. Blip Billboards. Oh, yes. Blip Billboards came through for me. Now, listen, I'm an affiliate, so I'm going to talk nice about Blip anyway. But guess what? My entire campaign was all screwed up. I had an absolute nightmare with it. It's true. On the 19th, things were not clicking, things were not working out, and I called their team. Of course, it was the 19th when I tried to get a hold of them or whatever it was, and they were closed for a couple of days, so I had to wait a couple of days. And that Monday, I got on the phone, and within 10 minutes on the phone, they fixed absolutely everything for me, and now my Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast banner has been seen on billboards all over St. John's now almost 2,000 times, and I could not have been more proud. That moment, I actually dropped off my I dropped my foster child off to a visit, and I was just driving by, and I hadn't seen it yet. These things had been up for 3 or 4 days, but it just so happened I hadn't seen the blip yet because they rotate, so you don't really get a chance. So I was kind of, I'll be honest, my mind was elsewhere, and then I looked up, and I was driving, I looked up, and then bam, there it was, the Eye of the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. What a cool feeling to see the podcast in lights. This is something that just, what a dream come true. What a dream come true. So you know, Blip's the real deal, guys. A little later in the show, you'll hear me read my ad before I have the guest on, but just remember that show link is down there for Blip. You go to my affiliate link, and you use my, basically my little product code there, and you'll get a $25 gift, basically, if you sign up and start a campaign with them. And how this works is that they'll actually give me credit as well for future campaigns, basically, the more people that sign up. So get on that. Great way to support the show, and thank you so much for doing that. More thank yous. I got more thank yous. I got to thank Podbean. Yeah, my host. Not only do I have to thank Podbean for, get this, just being an amazing host all year round. Let's face it, Podbean is awesome. And, you know, I've never had trouble with Podbean. There was a few snags over the last few years, but I mean, come on. I've been doing this now forever, for over 4 years. And Podbean have been very good to me. And I had no idea that they had decided to feature me twice this year in October. Now, last year I got featured in the scary story section. I had no idea they were doing that again this year, and bam, lo and behold, there I was. So you go to Scary Stories on the Podbean app, and you see all kinds of really cool paranormal podcasts in there, guys. Check it out. My fellow paranormal podcast, paranormal Podbeaners, I guess you could call us, we're on there. Jump in there, check them out. But thank you so much for helping me get more exposure, Podbean. Really, really do appreciate that, which is why I'm tagging you in this episode. But that's not it. That's not it. There was also a blog by one of the editors over at Podbean in October, and she put up their favorite, absolute favorite Halloween podcast. Now, they had done something similar to this last year, but guess what? They just mentioned things. They never actually put things up, so it was really, really cool to actually have that. So thank you so very much, Podbean. Super appreciate that. I'm on your blog. I mean, oh my God. I mean, how great can 1 month be? Featured in a magazine, doing events, featured twice on Podbean. I mean, it just, I can't thank you all enough. So very, very much. And, for all those involved behind the scenes at the Eye of the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast as well, Laura and Betty. Laura showed up to that, Laura, Dr. Laura, by the way, you know, as busy as she's been, she actually did take the time to show up to that ghost stories, that open mic ghost stories thing. And, she brought odd to do Philae buttons, and we passed them out. I thought that was so cool, right? So Laura's my merch girl now. Very good. Oh, my. Anyway, guys, just to kind of catch you up on things with me, I hope you guys had a safe and happy Halloween. I really do. And I hope everything's going great for you guys as we now, believe it or not, are heading into the Remembrance Day season here in Newfoundland, November 11th, which is why my guest later in the show is going to be talking about some haunted military type ghosts. So that's going to be really interesting. You know, we're keeping this kind of military theme, but yeah, here it is. I'm going to say it. Here it comes. The next episode is the Christmas special. So yeah, that's sinking. Are you in a panic yet? You got your gift spot? Black Friday is going to be here soon. Look out. Macy's Day Parade, baby. Looking forward to all of that. And before we jump into the paranormal news, just want to say as well that, oh yeah, I'm still doing the workouts. They're still happening. I was super sick last week. I had a chest infection and strep throat. It was disgusting. But guess what? This week, I toughed it out, baby. I got back on the weight. So guess what? There's just no derailing this gun show, this gun train. Gun train show. Train show. You know what? There you go. Just call me Train Show. Oh, man. And to top it all off, more people downloaded the bonus episodes of this show this month. Get this. I got more downloads in October than I got the entire year combined. Let that sink in. The entire year. We're talking thousands and thousands of downloads this month. Guys and gals, thank you so much for just making my month the best October ever. How are we going to top this? I mean, next year I'm going to like have to go like investigate or something live. I'm going to have to do something big because this year was just insane. The amount of progress we made. And when I look at those numbers and I know that people are subscribing like crazy to this show, they're supporting, they're liking the show, they're commenting. That's a big thing, commenting on the show, not just on Facebook, but like go to the actual website where it's hosted and comment and stuff. That is amazing. If you got the Podbean app and you're not following this show, do me a favor. Look down, scroll down, hit follow, leave a comment. Tell me about something you liked about the show, maybe something you hated. Doesn't matter. Just feedback is what we're looking for because it helps people decide whether or not they want to download the show. When I seen all those downloads, it just made me feel like all my hard work I put in paid off like crazy. Guys, I released, get this, including this episode, it'll be 7 episodes I've released in 4 weeks. That's an incredible amount of content. Now, mind you, some of the episodes are really short because they were oddities. And, I just threw those in there because that's something I do for somebody else's show, basically. But I threw them in there as kind of like little trick-or-treats for you guys. So please enjoy those oddities as little bonus episodes. But we had a great bonus episode mid-month with Alfred Santagria. Oh, man, that was just... People loved that show because it was a legit scary show. Stay out of the basement. And, of course, the one I released on the 1st of October, The Ghost at the Bar. Guys, check it all out. I mean, right now, if you took this show, there'd be 3 big long shows and a bunch of little ones. I mean, we got about 7 episodes. 7 hours. We got more than that. 7 episodes that you guys can just take right now, throw on in your car for your commute or whatever it is you're doing. So check it out. Anyway, enough of my bantering. You didn't come here to listen to me squawk on about how great everything's going. I just hope things are going really great in your world. And speaking of things going really great in worlds, it's time for the paranormal news.
Somewhere between the funnies and the obituaries. Is yes, the paranormal news.
Have you ever thought about parallel universes? Has that ever like kind of jumped in your mind? I mean, I think about it all the time as a possible explanation for the paranormal, but you know, there's this one hypothesis that suggests that the existence of countless other universes similar to ours, but they're a little bit different, exist. Which begs the question, does that mean there's another you in a parallel universe? The idea that we live in one of a particularly limitless number of near identical realities is nothing new. In one universe, for instance, you may have died in a car accident last month, while in another you might have become the President of the United States. every conceivable outcome has happened in and at least one of these universes, each version of history has played out somewhere. In his recent book, Something Deeply Hidden, physicist Sean Carroll from the California Institute of Technology delves into this concept in more detail. The idea of parallel universes, he argues, is a definite possibility. It's absolutely possible that there are multiple worlds where you made different decisions, he said during a recent interview with NBC. We're just obeying the laws of physics. We don't know whether the number of worlds is finite or infinite, but it's certainly a large number. According to the theory, each decision a person makes might split reality into two iterations, each following a different possible outcome. On this basis, Carroll argues parallel universes may not be situated at any particular place or time, but they may instead exist relative to the observer themselves. In the peculiar world of quantum mechanics, such a concept wouldn't be at all surprising. Before you look at an object, whether it's an electron or an atom or whatever, it's not in a definite location, said Carroll. It might be more likely that you observe it in one place or another, but it's not actually located at any particular place. As for visiting such alternative realities, however, Carroll remains skeptical. They don't interact. They don't influence each other in any form, he said. Crossing over is like traveling faster than the speed of light. It's not something you can do. Yet. Keyword here is yet. You know, I'll be honest, we all do some crazy things for love. I remember a certain singer talking about lying on a bed of nails. Well, what if I told you that there's actually daredevils out there that do this professionally? They lie on beds of nails. And not only that, though, there's actually a Guinness Book of World Record for the number of these people that will sandwich themselves on top of each other with the beds of nails. Yeah, this is a weird, odd story. Daredevil set new record for most layers in bed of nails is our next story. The spiky feet was especially uncomfortable for the person at the bottom, who pointed out that there was no thin person on our team. oh boy, that does not sound good. 9 martial artists stacked up on top of each other with an ominous-looking board of nails in between each person. This is the world record they tried to break. They were understandably a few grimaces from the man at the bottom of the stack, but the group managed to best the previous record of 8 by doing, you got it, 9. The attempt took place in Surat, Gujarat, and also saw Mr. Karate take the record for most iron bars bent with the neck in 1 minute. Mr. Karate said of the nail feet, this record is tough because gravity has to be defied. One has to play with gravity, and the weights are very, very heavy. My goodness gracious, it's a wonder they aren't just a bunch of pincushions by now. I'll tell you what'll wake you up in the middle of the night. This sound right here. You know what that is? That, my friend, is the sound of, well, Bigfoot, apparently. A family who had been out grouse hunting in Canada recently recorded some truly blood-curdling sounds. You can hear the daughter there in the background. The fascinating clip, which was uploaded to YouTube on October 3rd, was recorded by user Star Joe Blackstar, who had been out hunting with his wife and young grandson. They were approximately 45 kilometers from Sioux Lookout in Ontario, Canada, when they started to hear a series of loud, mournful screams coming from somewhere nearby. The chilling vocalizations continued for several minutes, leaving the couple very disconcerted. The video, which has racked up almost 45,000 views at the time of writing, has attracted quite a few comments from other users who've been speculating over what the creature might be. I looked up bear roar slash howls here on YT. They do not sound like that, wrote user Jen J. This sounds like a monster. Notice a stop when your little one yelled back? Yes, we noticed it stopped for a bit when my boy shouted back, the uploader replied. He started to get scared at the end of the video. You can listen to the recording for yourself below. The volume is so low. Headphones are advised. I'll fix that for you guys, though, okay? One thing's for sure, that thing is weird. What the hell is that, man? I've never heard that. That is creepy. And, you know, everybody's got a different definition of creepy. It's true.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Let me out!
Hello? Hello?
Let me out, dog in here.
That has had to be the greatest funeral prank ever committed. I want to die like this guy died. And you probably heard that online already yourselves. That is a guy speaking from beyond the grave at his own funeral in Ireland. His name is Shay Bradley, and he definitely got the last laugh out of all the mourners who were present, let me tell you, because just a shock with a hilarious pre-recorded message. I mean, this guy knew he was going to die years before. And the mourners who attended the funeral of the man in Ireland were left in shock when they heard his actual voice from beyond the grave. Let me out of this effing dark in here, cried Shay Bradley from his coffin as it was being lowered to the ground in Kilkenny on October 12th. And it really took the cake. Ensuring he got the last laugh of his own send-off, the 62-year-old Irish Defence Force veteran had his family and friends in fits of giggles rather than tears. And it's just so funny. And at the very end, he sings, "Hello again, hello, hello, I just called to say goodbye." It's just, it is well worth the look. If you guys haven't checked this out, you just got to listen to it. When I die, I want Aqua to play, I think. I think I want Barbie Girl to play. That'd be so funny. Like, as they lower me, and like, just for a laugh, as it's lowering, "I'm a Barbie girl," picture it lowering, "in a Barbie world." And then, like, we'll fake that something happened, and the whole thing will stop. And then I want to do the same thing and knock on the back of the casket and be like, "Hey, hey, turn back on Barbie girl." You know, Snowden is as Snowden does. Whistleblower Edward Snowden has revealed what he found when he searched the CIA for evidence of alien life. People have been sitting on their hands for a long time, very impatiently, waiting for Snowden to kind of come out and talk about what he actually saw. And let's be honest, if you had access to some of the nation's most sensitive information, what would you look for? I mean, obviously people are going to go in there looking for conspiracy stuff. Like, that's to be expected. But reality is, I'm going to look and see if they got aliens, man. During his time at the CIA, Snowden, who is now living as an exile in Moscow after famously disclosing information about numerous global surveillance programs, has recently admitted to searching through the CIA and NSA databases for evidence of extraterrestrial life. Writing in his recent memoir, Permanent Record, however, he admits to finding nothing of substance. For the record, as far as I could tell, aliens have never contacted Earth, or at least they haven't contacted U.S. intelligence, he wrote. The whistleblower also looked for information regarding a number of popular conspiracy theories. In case you were wondering, yes, man did really land on the moon, he wrote. Climate change is real, and chemtrails are not. Speaking on a recent episode of the Joe Rogan Experience, Snowden again confirmed that he'd been unable to find any evidence that suggested the U.S. knew of the existence of extraterrestrials. "I know, Joe, I know you want me to be here and say aliens are there," he said. "I know Neil deGrasse Tyson badly wants there to be aliens as well, and they're probably right, right? But the idea that we're hiding them, if we are hiding them, I had ridiculous access to the networks of the NSA, the CIA, the military, all these groups. I couldn't find a thing. If it's hidden, and it could be hidden, it's hidden really damn well, even from people who are on the inside." So there you have it. Snowden had nothing to whistleblow about seeing all those old things. My last little tidbit for the night, so to speak, is unfortunately a creature feature, and not the kind you're probably wanting to see, because zombie deer are threatening to invade a U.S. state. The contagious terminal illness has been compared to mad cow disease in cattle, making the deer lethargic, thin, and extremely weak. It may sound like the setup for a low-budget horror film, but wildlife officials have warned of the genuine threat of zombie deer. Regulators are working overtime to stop the afflicted animals from reaching Nevada, worried that the chronic wasting diseases that gives them their name could make them a danger to resident humans. The highly contagious terminal illness has been compared to mad cow disease in cattle and makes the deer lethargic and extremely weak, but also neutralizes their usual fear of people. It is transmitted by protein particles that cause irreparable damage to brain tissue and has the potential to wipe out entire populations of deer, moose, and elk. Dead animals are being tested for signs of the disease in Utah, which borders Nevada, and cases have already been reported in Kansas, Colorado, and even Wyoming. The National Health Protection Agency, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, believes the virus could be a risk to humans, with protein particles having been linked to similarly degenerative Jacob disease. According to a study by the Center of Food Security and Public Health, symptoms take at least 16 months to reveal themselves after exposure, and the average incubation period is 2 to 4 years. So think about that now. I mean, here we are. Christmas season is right around the frickin' corner, and we have zombie reindeer ready to take us out. Look, we haven't even got the decorations out. We're already got our lives threatened. For the love of God, boy. I love you guys. There's only one happiness in life, and that's to be loved and to be loved. And I just love you guys. We covered the idea that there might be another you in a parallel universe. Daredevils who broke the record for a sandwich bed of nails. An unnerving Bigfoot. That man was just creepy, creepy. A man speaking from the grave, literally, at his own funeral, making all of his relatives crack up laughing. Snowden the whistleblower has nothing but hot air to speak. And, of course, zombie deer are coming to ruin Christmas and kill us all before the holiday season. All these stories have been odd to Newfoundland.
Greetings from Betty, your Oracle, with words of wisdom for your consideration and entertainment for this month of November. November the 1st, known as the Day of the Children and All Saints Day, also my wedding day. November the 2nd is All Souls Day, or the Day of the Dead. During the days of the dead, some believe that souls of the departed return to earth to visit with, provide counsel, or give advice to family and loved ones. November 1st and 2nd are holidays in Mexico and South America, and that was taken actually from liveabout.com. In North America, the month of November symbolizes the last full month of autumn. It is the second to last month of 2019. And of course, November is the second to last month of every year. The days start to grow shorter. November is known as, there's all kinds of different things celebrated in November. So we have National Beard or No Shave Month, also known as Movember. We have Veterans Day in the U.S., Thanksgiving and Black Friday. The first Thursday in November is, get this ladies, Men Make Dinner Day. November 3rd, National Sandwich Day, which is also National Housewife Day. Oh, do I see a theme here? The housewives are being venerated and congratulated. November 5th, of course, is Guy Fawkes Night, where all those bonfires. November 14th is World Diabetes Day. November 16th is International Tolerance Day. I think every day should be International Tolerance Day. November 24th is International Evolution Day, otherwise known as All Our Uncles Are Monkeys Day. Very interesting information, and you can find any of this information when you type in Google for November or whatever your search engine is. November is known for quite a few things, from Academic Writing Month and Lung Cancer Awareness Month, Movember, and many other items we should be aware of. But the one that gives me the most pause is the fact that November is National Gratitude Month. Now, this topic has been a passion of mine for years. In my life, gratitude has taken me many, many places without my really even realizing it. When I talk about gratitude, I'm not talking about the kind of, yeah, great, thanks, kind of gratitude. I'm talking about the kind of gratitude that you feel deep in your soul. What would you feel like if the dream that you've been dreaming your whole life has finally come true? What kind of gratitude would you feel for that? And as I say that, I can hear people saying, how can gratitude take you anywhere? Let me say this. Gratitude taking you places has little to do with the words, thank you, but more to do with the vibration we raise within ourselves when we are grateful. And like I said, not that, yeah, thanks kind of gratitude. The kind of gratitude that you gave when you were a small child and you were given something that you absolutely adored. Or you got that ice cream that you've been waiting all week for. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. The very, very hairs on your head, the hairs on your arms stand up straight because you feel so incredibly grateful. The words thank you is lovely and mannerly and polite. But when we say them, do we actually mean them? So, you know, if someone picks something up off the floor for me, I say thank you and I mean it. I don't say it unless I mean it. And I'm not the type who will use words that I don't mean. And when I say thank you, it's coming from the bottom of my soul. Not because I feel like I have to say it. It's because what you've done for me is something I'm exceptionally grateful for. The smallest, tiniest thing. And you know what can make a huge difference in your life? I have seen it happen in mine. I've been watching it happen over the past year and a half. I started writing in a journal about a year and a half ago. I decided one night that it's time I had a regular, and I will use the word spiritual practice. I'm not religious. If anything, I can be called a pagan. Pagans believe in worshiping the earth. We believe that the earth is our mother and is helping to sustain us. Pagans want to take care of the land and one another. Pagans are not interested in the concept of religion. It's not even religion as we see religion in today's society. Not at all. If there is any religion to be gained from paganism, the religion would be more that we uphold our trees. We uphold the air we breathe. We believe that the earth sustains us and will always sustain us. That's basically paganism. And along with being pagan, of course, there's that W word called witch. I firmly believe that this gratitude journal, writing in this gratitude journal, and knowing that I myself am pagan, yes, I can call myself a witch. I've been called a witch by several people, actually, by loads of people. And it's not, to me, it's not, if somebody looks at me and says, you're a witch, that's got nothing to do with the way I look or the way I act. It's the way I think. So having said all that, this gratitude journal, about a year and a half ago, I decided on this practice. What would I do every single morning the same? I would take a journal, a book with empty pages, and just fill one page with gratitude and love. Because hand in hand with gratitude, of course, goes love. If you're thanking someone, it's also an expression of love for that person. If you're thanking the world for what it's given you, you're offering the world your love, which is absolutely beautiful. So I sit in the mornings, I write a full page of thank you, thank you, thank you. I always do it three times. I love you, I love you, I love you. That could be for the simplest thing. That could be for the bed I just got out of, how comfortable it was. Thank you, thank you, thank you for the beautiful night's sleep. I love you, I love you, I love you. Thank you, thank you, thank you for the beautiful sunshine. I love you, I love you, I love you. And when we say I love you, we say the words, but they're coming from our mouths. Those words come from our hearts as well as our minds. A lot of people can't say the word, I love you. They didn't grow up with it. When I was a small child, it wasn't something that was said in our house. And it wasn't until we all got older and understood why it wasn't said in our house. And it wasn't a horrible thing. My father was a fisherman. My father was at sea all the time. My mother loved us dearly, but the words didn't have to be said. Her actions did all of that. And Dad's when he was home from sea as well. And as we got older and we each started moving out, that's when the words, I love you, came out. And it was a lovely process to watch, to be quite honest, because as I've said a number of times before, I'm number five of six children. So to watch the progress of each one of us grow, marry, you know, or whatever, move out, just go on with our lives and realizing that as we get older, there's more love coming towards us. And because of gratitude, all because of gratitude. And you know what else gratitude brings into your life that blows my mind? Magic. I love magic. Now, I'm not talking about magic tricks. Yeah, they interest me, but I know that there's illusion involved with magic tricks. I'm more like the magic that life shows us every single day. So right now, we are in November. We are in that month where the leaves are almost all on the ground and yellow, orange, red, whatever colors they've turned. So here's where magic comes into play. The leaves fall and they're gone. Our trees are bare, empty, cold. We get cold wind. We're in North Atlantic here in Newfoundland. We get cold, cold wind. Those trees survive every single winter. They survive. And they come back and provide a canopy of leaves every summer for us. And that's not magic. How about those plants that you planted 2 years ago and you heard the word perennial? What does that mean? Well, they'll probably come back again. Come back again from what? Well, it's fall. It's really, really cold. So our plants are going to sleep. To us, it appears that they're dying. They're brown. They're limp on the ground now. They're not dying. they're sleeping, just like we do. And in the spring, when the sun comes back and brings its magical warmth to us, and that wind comes from the south and it feels warm again. How can that not be described as magic? So, a friend of mine, about a year ago, gave me a book. The book was written by a woman by the name of Deborah Blake. The book is called Everyday Witchcraft, Making Time for a Spirit in a Too Busy World. So I want to read, as I usually do now, I want to read a passage from this book. It's actually a couple of pages long. And it's about bringing magic into your everyday life. And the way they spell magic in this book, I love it. Because I'm the fairy girl. I love the fairies. And I like spelling fairy instead of F-A-I-R-Y. Yeah, that's how we learned to spell it in school. F-A-E-R-I-E. The fae. Bringing magic, M-A-G-I-C-K, into your everyday life. Here we go. Regular life is filled with the mundane. We have to clean our homes, go to work, make food, pay bills. Often there seems to be little room for the magical in the midst of all the chores that make up our everyday lives. But in fact, all these things are opportunities for magic. Remember that most pagans, as I said, in days gone by, there was no separation between the mundane and the magical. Protection spells were spun into yarn. Healing herbs were tucked into sachets under pillows and tossed into soups and stews. Witches hid their magic in plain sight by using it to cook and sew and sleep with. As modern witches, we can do the same, hidden or not, by integrating our magical work with the tasks we do every day. What follows are a few examples of ways to do this. And if they don't suit you, all you have to do is look at your daily life, break it down into tasks, and figure out ways to make a few of them magical. So, food magic. Putting a magical touch into the food you prepare, whether for yourself or for those you love, is a tried and true witchcraft tradition. I'm not talking about sneaking a love potion into someone's drink. Never a good idea, believe me. But women and men have been stirring magic into their food since the dawn of time. Spices from the warm hearth, herbs for protection and health, all these things have been used for centuries, and there is no reason why you can't come up with your own modern variations on the theme. For instance, I mentioned before that what I do call kitchen alchemy every morning when I make my hot chocolate. You're probably wondering how hot chocolate could be magical. Well, other than the chocolate part, which is pretty wonderful all by itself, as with most magic, it has to do with focus and intent. Because I make it so often, I actually have a nifty machine that mixes, heats, and froths the hot milk. As I place each ingredient inside, I focus on its magical qualities, milk for health and healing, chocolate for prosperity and love, a spoonful of honey for healing and energy, a pinch of cayenne pepper for energy and creativity, a bit of cinnamon for prosperity and love, and coffee for energy. Yes, technically this makes it mocha. It is just that easy. Take a food or drink that you have already made, and find its magical qualities. Almost all foods have some. And how you use them is only limited by your imagination. For instance, if you're having a special dinner with your significant other, you can use ingredients that enhance love, such as apples, cinnamon, and chocolate. Dessert, anyone? You can't help make someone love you with magical food, but you can use it to help create a positive mood. If you're packing a lunch for a child, why not add in some protective or love foods and herbs? Spread a little mustard on a sandwich and visualize its protection qualities. A handful of almonds is good for both health and protection. Having the boss over for dinner? Throw some herbs for success in the stew. Okay, don't make the stew if your boss is coming over. That's just wrong, but you see my point. So if your boss is coming over, you might want to give him something better than the stew. Let's go to fiber and clothing magic. People, women especially, have been using fiber for magical work forever. This is me, Betty. This is not the book. I do quite a lot with fabric, and every single thing that I do with fabric, there is intention in all of it, and it's all love intention. I never, ever, ever send out any dark intentions. They're always very, very light. I'm the one who looks for the light all the time. Back to the book. Back in the days when people made their own clothing, it was easy to spin protection into the wool your husband wore while he was out hunting, or put love into every stitch of a quilt. But you don't have to spin or weave or use fiber magic. And now, as then, your endeavors can be subtle and hidden from sight. Here are a few suggestions for ways to use thread, yarn, and clothing to work everyday magic with no one the wiser. Knot magic, K-N-O-T. Knots are a traditional form of binding magic, which ties your intentions into string, ribbon, or whatever you are knotting. You can make a knotted bracelet out of colorful fibers and reinforce your goal for healing and prosperity, etc., with every knot you tie. You can also do knot magic while you are sewing. For instance, if you have a child going off to camp and you are sewing name labels into her clothing, simply tie extra knots and fill each one with your wish for protection. For a fast and easy magical spell, use any piece of string or yarn and say the following while tying 9 knots and visualize your desire. By the knot of 1, the spell's begun. By the knot of 2, it cometh true. By the knot of 3, so mote it be. By the knot of 4, open the door. By the knot of 5, the spell's alive. By the knot of 6, the spell is fixed. By the knot of 7, the stars of heaven. By the knot of 8, the stroke of fate. By the knot of 9, this thing is mine. We can go on and on. There's thread magic, clothing magic, knitting and sewing magic, and it's all basically using the same. So with thread magic, easy to work magic with nothing more than a simple piece of thread and a needle. Just use thread to sew a symbol or ruin into a piece of clothing, like a heart inside of a shirt or jacket for someone you want to feel love. You want them to feel love all day. So just sew a little heart in there. Or the ruin gifu, which looks like an X for prosperity, on the side of your purse or wallet. And then we go down to musical magic and singing in the shower. I have to read this one to you. So musical magic, singing in the shower. There's nothing particularly magical about singing in the shower unless you're using a nice witchy chant. Then you can start or end your day by an uplifting spiritual note. My particular favorites are the classic She Changes Everything She Touches or Fire Am I. But there are lots of great ones out there. Check out YouTube or find a CD with chants on it if you don't already have ones you use. And then the drums, if you do some drumming, there's all kinds of ways to incorporate spiritual, and as this witchcraft book put it, witchy, magical things in every single day. And I love to get up every morning and look for the magic in the day. And that's one of the things I write on my journal page. What magic will you show me today? And that's always my first question. My last words in that book are always, thank you, thank you, thank you. I love you, I love you, I love you. And just one simple page. And it doesn't have to be one of those great big journals. I use just your average size journal. You can get them anywhere from the dollar store to Kohl's and Chapters, wherever your heart desires, you can find a journal. And also another way to cement gratitude. And this is going to be my last note for this recording today. Another way that you can infuse gratitude into your life is at night when you go to bed. Generally, when we go to bed at night, we lay there and we go over everything that's gone on through the day. And our minds, because we are these human beings having this human experience, we go through all of the not so good things that went on through the day. So what happens then? We go through all these good things. We slip into a sleep while we're going through them, and we end up stewing on them while we're asleep, not even knowing it. What I suggest is when you get in bed at night, you want to go over that list of things that happened during the day. Do that before you actually lie down. When you lie down and close your eyes, then give thanks and be grateful for every single thing that happened throughout the day, good, bad, or indifferent. Because I'm going to tell you, even in the heaviest, darkest moments, there's always a lesson to be learned. There is always something to learn from it. And I'll just use something John said a couple of nights ago. There has to be contrast in this world. We're not going to go around 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day, every week, happy, 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 happy. Life is not meant to be lived that way. Life is meant to be lived, but it is also meant to be learned from. So be thankful when the lessons come, because as dark as they can be, know there is just as bright a light on the other side of that dark. With those words, I give you back to John. Happy November, everyone.
Dr. Norris Lair. Power on. I'll get the broom.
Hi, everyone, and a happy November to one and all. This month, I wanted to talk a bit about the importance of penicillin and its impact on World War II in particular. I'm using content by Richard Connett from his wonderful pieces published on HistoryNet and in Military History magazine. In December 1943, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill was homeward bound across North Africa after a series of meetings with world leaders in the Middle East. He was 69 years old at that time, tired, overweight, an avid drinker and smoker with a bad heart. And now, his transport plane had dropped down in Tunisia. He presented with a case of nasty pneumonia, to which he was prone. His condition quickly deteriorated. As his heart went into fibrillation, doctors were unsure if they could even save the man who had once rallied the beleaguered British nation with his cry of blood, toil, tears, and sweat. He was not an ideal patient. He agreed to lay off cigars and take his whiskey more or less watered, but he continued to see visitors and do his normal business. What followed, despite the patient, was reportedly a triumph of modern medicine, though in retrospect of propaganda. British newspapers enshrined the new wonder drug penicillin as the Prime Minister's savior, and their reports quickly grew into legend. When Churchill was a boy, the story went, a man had saved him from drowning, prompting Churchill's grateful father to pay for the man's son to attend medical school. That son was the one and only Alexander Fleming. He had in turn discovered the penicillin that supposedly saved Churchill's life. But this wondrous fable, as Fleming himself referred to the ironic sequence of events, has fundamental fact-checking issues. Churchill had not experienced a near-death drowning in his youth. The Churchills and Flemings weren't acquainted. And what cured the Prime Minister's pneumonia wasn't even penicillin at the time. Instead, as he publicly declared after, a sulfa drug. The myth-making about penicillin was perhaps understandable. The new wonder drug was a British discovery, and while the sulfa drugs themselves had originated in Germany. And while the sulfa derivatives had seemed like wonder drugs when they were first introduced, penicillin was clearly superior. The first previous shipments had already demonstrated an almost miraculous ability to prevent and treat infections during field trials on wounded soldiers in North Africa and Italy. And even Churchill lay ill with pneumonia. One of his intending physicians published an article in the Lancet Medical Journal about his successful experiments with penicillin. That was Lieutenant Colonel Pulvertaft. Pulvertaft predicted a revolution in treatment of wounded soldiers, and that sepsis, acute blood poisoning, as we know, it might almost disappear if sufficient penicillin were available. But that was a big if. Pulvertaft did not even have enough drug, or even he could be sure was non-toxic, to risk treating the Prime Minister. Penicillin was so precious and flushed so rapidly out of the patient's body that researchers still commonly recovered it from urine and purified it and then reinjected it. At the outset of 1944, penicillin was the object of a massive Anglo-American effort to wrap up production ahead of the D-Day invasion. The outcome of the entire war and lives of tens of thousands of soldiers hung in the balance. Today, we take antibiotics for granted, 100%. If we get a fever, we visit the doctor, swallow a few pills, and then call back a little irritated if our condition is not cleared up after a couple days. And this is one of the major things that's really spurning and increasing antimicrobial resistance. But that's for a different day. The soldiers who fought in World War II had grown up in a different world. They had never known children who died of blood poisoning from causes such as trivial as a splinter, never mind a bullet wound. And they had been lucky enough to survive the waves of diarrhea, bronchitis, and other infectious diseases that came on as dependably as the summer. Plenty of other children had it. To them, antibiotics were a miracle, and it had started not with penicillin, but with those German sulfa drugs. Gernhard Domnack, the German pathologist who had developed those drugs into the first effective tools for fighting bacterial infection, had demonstrated their own effectiveness on his own 6-year-old daughter, who had accidentally pierced her own arm with an embroidery needle that led to a significant and severe infection of her arm. Surgeons repeatedly opened and drained the abscess wound to no effect, as the feverish child lapsed in and out of consciousness. They had even planned to amputate. This German pathologist balked and turned to desperation of his own experimental sulfa drug called Prontosil. Within days, this little girl, Hildegard, walked out of the hospital on her own. Prontosil had not just saved her arm, but her life. Within a year, Prontosil had cured Franklin Delano Roosevelt Jr., the son of the American president, of severe strep, and sulfa drugs had become a press sensation in the U.S. Their effectiveness against conditions such as scarlet fever to pneumonia quickly earned the reputation for snatching patients out of the grave. They secured their reputation on December 7, 1941, in the treatment of horribly wounded victims of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Soon, every soldier going into combat carried sulfa pills and powder in their first aid kit. The scene of a soldier or medic tearing open a sulfa packet and sprinkling it on a wound to prevent infection has really been immortalized in countless World War II films. But it remains uncertain just how much of a difference sulfa drugs made on the battlefield. They played a major part in controlling outbreaks of dysentery, for sure, among Allied troops. And again, during a meningitis outbreak at military bases in Britain. Acute respiratory diseases, including influenza, pneumonia, bronchitis, and other diseases, had killed almost 50,000 U.S. soldiers in World War I. During World War II, with twice as many men and women in uniform, only 1,265 died. The main difference, based on the U.S. military's own analysis, was the wide use of these sulfa drugs. But many diseases soon began to resist treatment, probably because sulfa drugs were used way too often. To stave off venereal diseases, for instance, some soldiers thought it might help to swallow a couple of sulfa tablets before heading out for a night on the town. That kind of overuse only served to knock out susceptible pathogens, clearing the field for resistant pathogens to flourish. Resistant gonorrhea became an increasingly common problem. Sulfa drugs also failed to work in combat nearly as well as they had hoped. Colonel Elliot Cutler, the Army's chief surgeon consultant in the European theater, wrote in May 1943 that even under optimal conditions, sulfa drugs did not keep infections away from wounds, though they may have stemmed the spread of existing infections. Cutler could not even say with confidence that sulfa drugs, as used by the U.S. Armed Forces, had actually saved lives. Soldiers themselves, on the other hand, had absolute faith in this magic powder. Almost to a man, the soldiers have said, when questioned, that their lives were saved by the use of sulfa drugs, Cutler wrote. He recognized the value of that psychological effect, but he also knew that wounded soldiers deserve the physiological and psychological benefits in one single drug. Most history books trace the development of penicillin, what would become the wonder drug of the 20th century, to Alexander Fleming, a quiet Scottish microbiologist at St. Mary's Hospital in London. Returning to his lab from summer vacation in 1928, he noticed that flecks of mold had some way found their way into a petri dish in which he was growing Staphylococcus bacteria. Encircling the mold, oddly, was a halo, or a little circle, in which the bacterium had not grown or had been killed off. Fleming experimented with the antimicrobial effects of penicillium mold and soon published his research about the extract he named penicillin. But Fleming's article drew little attention and he just moved on to other research. The real work to turn penicillin into a practical antibiotic did not begin until 1938 under the direction of Howard Florey, an Australian pharmacologist, and Ernst Chain, a German-born Jewish refugee at Oxford University. They would later share the Nobel Prize with Fleming for this work. In August 1940, they published results from the first experiments on mice, showing, among other things, that penicillin appeared non-toxic and could combat a variety of pathogens, including the bacteria that causes gangrene. The timing of their publication in The Lancet seems now a little surprising breach of wartime secrecy. The Battle of Britain was raging in the skies overhead, and the Oxford researchers were so concerned about an imminent German invasion that they rubbed penicillin spores into the fabric of their jackets. That way, if forced to destroy their work and evacuate, they would at least have the raw material to start up again wherever they ended up. Yet, in 1940 and again in 1941, Florey's team published evidence of what penicillin could accomplish, along with detailed instructions for its manufacture in a prominent medical journal that inevitably found its way into enemy hands. Perhaps it all seemed too small scale and slow developing to be a practical use in the war that was engulfing them. As the BBC warned in a September 1942 broadcast about penicillin, good science is not often quick in getting results. The penicillium mold only grew in a film a few millimeters thick on the surface of a growth medium, and the Oxford biochemist Norman Heatley constantly struggled to eke out enough of the stuff for even experimental purposes. But that was all about to change. The turning point came in July 1941, when Florey and Heatley traveled to the U.S. in search of help. Researchers there quickly recognized the importance of this team's work, and between the two of them, they soon turned penicillin from an obscure research project into a mass-produced here and now means of saving lives. Through a connection at Yale University, and by extraordinary good luck, they found their way to Percy A. Wells, a U.S. Department of Agriculture administrator with an interest in, of all things, mold fermentation. In an offhand note in a telegram, Wells suggested researchers there should attempt to submerge fermentation producing penicillin not in a thin layer on the surface of pans, but in huge vats. Some British writers have bemoaned and complained about giving away penicillin to the Americans. Ronald Hare, an assistant to Fleming, took particular satisfaction in depicting the United States as a land of cornpoke, cowboys, and maverick manufacturing operations. But that would turn out to be just what penicillin needed. Because Peoria was in the Corn Belt, fermentation producers were accustomed to working with corn steep liqueur, or liquor, a watery byproduct from the process of turning corn into cornstarch. It proved to be an excellent medium for penicillium mold to grow in, with chemical precursors that actually boosted the production. Wonderful. Following Wells' suggestion, researchers there soon demonstrated that they could grow a soup, a penicillium mold, and corn liquor in vats, like oversized milkshake machines, with an agitator shaft in the middle to keep things oxygenated and stirring. Incidentally, they also found a higher quality strain of penicillium growing on a rotten melon at a local marketplace. By November 1941, the Peoria effect had already boosted production tenfold, with exponentially greater progress still to come. Hare, who worked on penicillin production in Canada, also mocked the Americans for putting the entire penicillin effort under the thumb of a martini-loving dictator of penicillin in Washington. Wells had to approve everything we did or required. We were, for a time, mortally afraid of him, they said. But again, a dictator proved just what the penicillin effort had actually needed to coordinate the far-flung efforts of research laboratories, universities, government agencies, and pharmaceutical companies on both sides of the Atlantic. Microbiologist Gladys L. Hobby later described this ambitious program as rivaled only by the Manhattan Project. Though she did not say as much, penicillin would have as a profound effect as the atomic bomb in making the modern world, sparing tens of millions of lives and liberating humanity from the grip of dreaded diseases, according to the author. Hobby was present, for instance, the day in October 1943 when a researcher announced to peers that penicillin seemed to provide a quick and easy cure for syphilis. It would also prove effective against resistant gonorrhea. Everyone strained to hear what was said, Hobby recalled, and the impact was electrifying. And then much had been written on penicillin, but no one expected that an antibiotic reagent would be effective against spirochetes as well. Spirochetes are what syphilis is, rather. Venereal diseases were rampant in wartime, and the discovery of a cure immediately raised debate about whether scarce supplies should go first to treat soldiers wounded on the battlefield or those wounded in the bordellos. The bordello actually made more practical sense, since you could cure a soldier and send him back to the front in a matter of days. Astonishingly, some politicians made common sense choice, with Churchill ordering medical staff to put battlefield readiness foremost. Allied businesses and governments were lavishing tens of millions of dollars on highly coordinated campaigns to bring penicillin to market. In March 1944, just 18 months after the BBC had reminded its listeners that good science goes slow, the factory began pouring out penicillin from 14 fermenters, each with a capacity of 7,000 gallons. 4 months later, on June 6, 1944, Allied soldiers carried the penicillin with them onto the beaches of Normandy. Perhaps it is too much to suggest that penicillin helped win World War II. But it really must have felt that way, at least on a personal level, to the 100,000 or so men, by one conservative estimate, who actually benefited from penicillin treatment in the European theater between D-Day and the final German surrender. Penicillin also saved thousands of lives during the last bloody year of combat in the Pacific. To military surgeons, the arrival of penicillin was indeed a miracle. In the early years of the war, when a medical convoy came in, surgeons working at field hospitals commonly rushed down the line of injured soldiers, tearing off dressings in search of clean wounds. It was a crude and painful form of triage to weed out the cases that were already too badly infected to have much of a chance of recovery. Meanwhile, as penicillin remained scarce, German prisoners, however, received sulfa drugs and suffered gangrene at a rate of 20 to 30 per thousand. Penicillin made a miraculous difference in the war, and may we never forget those who have gone before us.
Attention all Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio listeners. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast brings you the best in East Coast esoterica on the first of every month. Together, we can keep it growing by sharing the show on social media, subscribing to the show wherever you may be listening to it from, and by leaving feedback about your favorite episodes. John certainly needs a friend like you to help make his dreams come true, minus the alien abduction dreams. That is not cool at all. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast, always available, always free, always odd.
Welcome back to the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. But before we get to tonight's amazing guest, the whole premise of this podcast is about discovering things that are out of the ordinary. I've recently found a service that helps businesses stand out from the crowd. It's called Blip Billboards. They help businesses of any size, just like yours, with any budget, just like yours, get seen on large format digital billboards. Yeah, not like yours. Ha ha. For me, seeing my podcast on a big billboard to get the word out was a dream come true. And I want you to have that as well. I never thought in a million years that I could ever afford this stuff. But thanks to Blip and their pay what you want approach, this dream is a reality that truthfully didn't cost a whole lot and didn't take a whole lot of my time either. All you do is pick the billboard you'd like to advertise on, set your daily schedule, and budget. Then upload your ad design, bada bing. Once your ad is approved, bada boom, your ad will be live for everyone to see. Blip Billboard is great for standing out locally or boosting awareness nationally. So whether you're a small tech startup, a local restaurant, or anywhere in between, your business can now afford to make these big impressions in all the locations that matter to you. So what would your Blip Billboard say? Well, let me tell you. If you go to my special URL that you're going to find really in the show notes of this podcast, you're going to sign up for a free account. Yeah, costs nothing. And just because you're a listener and a fan of the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast, you're going to get a $25 Blip credit to help you get started. All you got to do is put in blipbillboards.com/odd once you follow my very special link. It's all down in the show notes. Anyway, try this out. If you got something you need to promote, a book, an event, anything at all, give Blip a shout, give him a try, and support the podcast. And hey, why not get $25 Blip credit while you're at it? Tonight's guest, well, really is a part of a very interesting family. Tonight's guest is going to be talking a little tiny bit in the spirit of Remembrance Day, which is on the 11th of November here in Canada. We're going to be talking a little bit about some of the haunted military-style places, so to speak, or anything to do with spirits in the military with tonight's guest. He's actually got a new book out. It's called Family Spirits, The Adventures and Evidence of Gallo Family Ghost Hunters. It's him, two girls, and his wife. That's right, his family. He brings them in the field. This is amazing. An interesting concept. And, you know, would certainly have helped me if I had come up with the idea. I wouldn't have to pay for a babysitter every time I went ghost hunting. Dude, that would have been so awesome. Tonight's guest is none other than Bobby J. Gallo. Bobby, how are you tonight, sir?
I am doing great. It's really wonderful to be on your show. Thank you so much.
I am a big fan of anybody who does things different. And let me tell you, you definitely have a habit of doing things different, and that's great. Because guess what? Different sometimes gets different results. So before we jump into how you became the, well, really, the family who seeks ghosts, I think that's a first, you know? It really is, in my world anyway. I know this almost has started somewhere for you, Bobby. So please tell me how you got into the paranormal how you got into the field.
Well, I started in the paranormal back in the late 80s and early 90s, honestly, even before the term paranormal investigator was even coined. A group of friends and I got together. We wanted to investigate an old haunted theater that was actually built by my great uncle back in the early part of the 20th century. And we called ourselves the Psy Guys because one of the group insisted that we have a name. And we started basically winging it. We had absolutely nothing to go by. We were, you know, using things like analog tape recorders, a video camera, a 35 millimeter camera. We made a little pendulum, you know, with an old key on a piece of string, and we started gathering some evidence. It was a great investigation. I actually have it on video and is actually the very first episode of our web series, believe it or not, just for nostalgic reasons. But after that, I pretty much let it go, and I became a professional magician for about 15 years full time, touring around the world. And I got married, had kids, and it was time for me not to be a magician anymore because it was time to raise my family. So years later, we're sitting in our living room, and we're watching this new show on the Travel Channel called Ghost Adventures, and I'm sure you've heard of it. And
bro, have we ever? Keep going.
And it was – all of a sudden, I turned to my kids, and I said, you know, kids, Daddy used to do that too. And it was like that scene from the movie Spy Kids when the kids turned and say, my parents aren't cool enough to be spies. It was it was a revelation to them. They had absolutely no idea up to that point that I was ever a paranormal investigator or a quote-unquote ghost hunter. And suddenly, no fear, no hesitation, they wanted to go ghost hunting. And I thought, you know, this might be cool because as a magician – one of the things we like to do is try to debunk anything that's fraudulent. Houdini used to do that back in the early part of the 20th century. He used to like debunk fraudulent spiritualists and whatnot as part of his show. So I thought, let me see if I go out in the field and I'm going to do exactly what these guys on TV are doing. And I want to see if I can capture this kind of evidence. I mean, even if I can capture one EVP, which I never had before, even in the early part of my investigations, one spirit photo, you know, have one really solid experience. How cool would that be? Well, we went out to the field. I bought some rudimentary equipment and we started investigating. And lo and behold, I'm capturing evidence like these guys on TV, except then I realized this evidence is real. These experiences are real. You know, and that kind of blossomed what we did. I said, okay, you know, it might be, let me put a few of these episodes or investigations. They weren't really episodes yet on YouTube, and let's see what happens. So I put a couple investigations on YouTube, and all of a sudden these things went completely viral. We were getting tens of thousands of hits on YouTube. And it was then when I figured, you know, there might be something here. We gave ourselves a name, Gallo Family Ghost Hunters, and we went on to do about 60 episodes. And, you know, it's just been a really great experience. That's how we started.
I think it's just – I gotta kind of go back just a little tiny bit there because you mentioned Houdini and you were a magician and stuff like that. So like in an alternate universe, you know, you're James Randi debunking this stuff and, you know, supposedly having that $1 million, which, you know, to this day, we still don't know if that's actually real either.
But I will say this.
It's such a cool concept because I can really relate because one of my things was as an EVP guy, like, the first thing I said to people is I work alone. I don't have anybody with me. People are too noisy. People fart. People move. It ruins everything. Like, I work alone. Always have, always will. Right? And people were always like, man, you can't do that. That's so dangerous and blah, yada, yada. So, you know, I kind of feel like I got that rebel vibe because guess what? You're taking your family with you into some of the most haunted places in the States. So this is going to be a real interesting ride here. And to kind of connect it back to your background and how you got into this stuff, I cannot wait for the day where my daughter looks at me and says, Dad, can you take me out ghost hunting? I can't friggin' wait. Anyway.
It's very cool.
Oh, really, man, such a cool thing. And you know what? You know, if you can get her to do the EVP work, even better, because it's horrible. It takes forever. Tell me about this wife of yours. Tell me about, she must be one special lady. So let's hear a little bit about her.
Yes, yes, Renee. Yes, she is absolutely a special lady and very talented, might I add. She was on board with it from the beginning for the educational aspects of it, because we were going to a lot of locations such as battlefields and whatnot that were very historic. And every time we would go out, not only were we ghost hunting, but the kids were learning. I mean, we'd go to St. Augustine, Florida, which was, you know, which is the oldest city in the United States. We would go to all sorts of places, and they were always learning. Not to mention the fact that they were really learning to become fearless young women. So Renee was on board with it from the beginning, and, you know, unknown to her and unknown to me at the time, she actually had some really incredible gifts as an intuitive, you know, psychic, if you will, because she was – I had bought her a pair of dowsing rods just on a hunch, and I said, you know, honey, why don't you try these? I tried them. They didn't work for me. She took these rods and immediately – it was like she was using them her entire life. And we would go on investigations, and she proved to be so good with these dowsing rods that I ended up trusting them more than my most advanced equipment. She was truly that good. And I've had our videos literally studied by some of the best paranormal people in the business, and they examined her hands, and she doesn't move a muscle. Yet she can make those things move on command, and she's just captured some incredible communications.
Man. So, like, got to put a ring on that, right? Make no wonder. I don't want to talk too much about your kids, but they sound like they're the coolest kids ever. Let's hear a little tiny bit about your girls and how they are in the field. Like, so you mentioned already that they're learning, they're doing these kind of things. So, like, have you noticed any talents in them yet that are just kind of individualized, so to speak, when it comes to the paranormal? Like, for me, I know that I'm super into EVP, but hand me the camera and I'll be like, I don't know what to do with this. What would you say your kids' strong points are in the field?
Well, you know, on the subject of my kids, Nicolette, Nikki G is her handle in the show. Her specialty is that she is an empathic investigator, and she actually can sense a great deal on an investigation. Again, this was something that we never even knew until we got out into the field. And my youngest daughter, Courtney, who we call the ghost magnet because whenever she's around, the equipment lights up, she can see orbs. And she saw them on several occasions, and we've gotten photographic evidence. We've actually taken the picture of the orbs where she said she saw the orbs. Like, you know, for instance, we were in a haunted theater, and the stairway that was going up to the balcony in this theater had a reputation for being haunted. Well, during the investigation, she says, "Dad, I see two orbs dancing on the stairway." I said, "Seriously?" She says, "Yeah." So I got the video camera, and which I already had running, and I couldn't see a thing. When we got home and we did evidence review, there they were. And there were other instances as well where she saw orbs and we photographed them. So she had that talent.
That's incredible. And, like, who better to have with you on an investigation than people you trust with the utmost? Your own family. So, time to segue a little tiny bit into some of these places you actually kind of started mentioning. Like, I believe you said, was it St. Augustine?
Yes, St. Augustine, Florida.
Augustine, sorry. Tell me a little tiny bit about that investigation and some of the evidence you managed to capture. Really would love to hear about anything at all military, you know, for our service women, past and present out there, wink, wink. I would love to hear anything at all that you guys have found that has anything at all to do with the military.
Well, actually, we have done quite a few investigations in places where there were military conflicts and whatnot. And also one really fantastic investigation at Salisbury National Military Cemetery in Salisbury, North Carolina. And if anybody knows anything about Salisbury, North Carolina, that was the site, you know, during the American Civil War, there was a prisoner of war camp there, very brutal. And many, many soldiers died in that camp. And my oldest daughter, Nicolette, at the time, she was in ROTC in high school. So we went there because she was really into the whole military thing, if you will, at the time. And she immediately took command of that entire investigation. And we got the most incredible piece of evidence. She was saying oorah to the spirits that were present. And if you know anything about that, that saying, that's a motivational call. It's kind of like a pickup line for the U.S. Marine Corps. And all of a sudden on an EVP, we didn't get one. We got what appeared to be an entire platoon saying it back to her. Mm. And I actually have a skeptic friend who actually did the afterword to Family Spirits, our book. And she's a staunch skeptic, in a good way. She's one of those good paranormal skeptics. She really tries to find scientific explanations to things. However, when she heard this EVP, she was absolutely floored. She couldn't believe it. And it was a direct response to my daughter giving a salute to these military spirits, and they were giving her a salute back.
That to me is just that's the difference between like a good EVP and a not so good EVP. And unfortunately, the ones you see on TV almost all the time are what I would consider a not so good EVP. So right. When I hear something like that, like to me right away, when it's in direct response and it's intelligent and especially if it's multiple words or a specific word, man, oh man, that's hard to not. It just seems so much more credible than say, you know, you hear the word bleh come through a ghost box or something. And then, you know, it's, the entire episode is based around how haunted this house is. So that sounds awesome. And I'm glad that you actually get some feedback there. I remember one time, oddly enough, I was also in a cemetery here in St. John's, Newfoundland, which is the oldest city in North America. So we've got some really old stuff here. And, you know, as soon as we went by the service women and service men portion of the cemetery, we got Sir, Yes, Sir. So, you know, these EVPs are there. But I digress. Bobby, you're into a lot of paranormal stuff. Have you ever actually had a run-in with like a military base, so to speak, or anything like that?
I'm not so sure a military base, so to speak, but what we have done is we've really investigated a lot of military battlefields, and we really do get a lot. And we more times than not, when we do find some type of wandering spirit in a military battlefield. And I just want to, you know, clarify to your listeners, I do come from the viewpoint that these are ghosts, these are spirits. That's what I'm communicating with. So I do come from that point of view. And even in Family Spirits, I write from the perspective that ghosts exist, because at this point, I'm kind of like really past whether or not they're there. I know they're there. We have the evidence. You know, is it proof? No, it is not proof, but it is incredibly compelling evidence. So when I'm in these battlefields, we run across a lot of these, you know, these fallen soldiers, and more often than not, you know, we have had some really heartbreaking experiences, even at times some negative experiences, because we run into some that, don't know how to move on from that particular location. We once actually had a loyalist, an English loyalist soldier, and this was in Kings Mountain Battlefield, who found out when he found out my wife was French, he got angry. And, you know, and we also had another spirit there with a very clear EVP, and it was a full sentence. When I asked, is there anything we can do to help you? He said, help me out of here. Complete sentence. And, you know, it was really, you know, it's an amazing experience, especially when you contact them. But yeah, you know, we don't know how to help these spirits, or, you know, at least that's what we think they are. So, you know, or, you know, maybe it's not even our job to do it, but we have had so many experiences in battlefields.
And, you know, one of the things I wrote about my own book actually was the idea that it's not necessarily a haunted house or a haunted battlefield, but the whole world is haunted, really. It's just things go on in these areas, and it's almost like a stimuli that kind of makes it haunted. And, you know, when I think of a battlefield, I can't think of somewhere that's more charged with emotion. I mean, people are killing other people and being killed in front of each other. It's pretty, doesn't get much worse than that, really. I'd like to think.
Exactly.
What do you think is going on with all this stuff? You know, let's just focus kind of really in on the ghosts here. Just that part of the paranormal. What would be your idea? Like, what causes these places to be haunted? And, you know, to me, everyone's got their own explanation, but what kind of makes it, what feels right in your soul, so to speak?
Well, that's a really good question. And the answer is that there is no cookie cutter reason why places are haunted. Now, in the case of a battlefield, it's exactly what you said. It's, you know, the events that played out there were so tragic and dramatic that a lot of the energy is literally absorbed into the surroundings, which could account for a lot of residual hauntings. Things like horses galloping, which we've heard and recorded, you know, footsteps, gunfire, which we've also recorded. We've, you know, we hear a lot of anomaly like that and witness a lot of anomaly like that, which could be residual, because compare it to, you know, the triangle, which is the musical instrument that you tap and it produces a tone, you know. It takes about 5 seconds for that tone to disappear, but that vibration is still there. And on a quantum level, it may be there for years. We really don't know. So it's kind of, that's the way this energy is absorbed into the surroundings in a haunted location. Now, it may not all be residual. Why are actual spirits there? Well, you know, we don't know, and we are trying to find out those answers. But I can tell you this, in the case of very old cemeteries, we had a hypothesis where the old Protestant religions actually, as part of their religion, believe that you're supposed to sleep in your grave until Judgment Day, you know, rest in peace. And so, you know, a lot of these spirits, if you will, have not moved on. They're there by choice. So that would explain to us, like, you know, we don't get a lot of activity in newer cemeteries, but we go into an older cemetery, let's just say Victoria era and prior, and the place lights up. You know, these old 200-year-old burial grounds are very, very active. So we, you know, I talk about this in Family Spirits, and I've, you know, partnered with some other paranormal investigators, as well as a very well-known author in the field of metaphysics. And he agrees that this may be the reason that these older cemeteries are haunted. So, again, there's no one cookie cutter reason. We know that there's an intangible part of us that goes on after we die, but they may choose to stay in different places for different reasons. And then, of course, there's the most popular theory being unfinished business. And that could account for a large number of hauntings.
I like to think that Las Vegas must be insanely haunted. Because if I was going to haunt somewhere, I think I want to haunt Vegas, because it seems like it's the most fun, you know? And, you know, I like to think that quarters never run out in the afterlife. They're always there.
Yeah, right.
One of the coolest things that happened in our little meeting over the last few weeks was you reached out to me and you sent me a copy of this just wonderful book. It's time to drop its title once again, because I think it's very, very important to promote my people who are on my show. Family Spirits, The Adventures and Evidence of Gallo Family Ghost Hunters. Get on there. It's all over the place. You know, but there's one thing that stuck out to me right away. Not only does it say by Bobby J. Gallo, who happens to be a friend of mine now, but the foreword was by Fiona Broom. And this lady is very near and dear to me, yet I've never had a chance to actually talk to her. Fiona was somebody I used to listen to about 6 years ago when she used to do her own podcast about ghost hunting. And it was really cool that we had that weird connection, because I was like, man, like, Fiona Broom, it can't be the same woman. And here it was the same woman. She's like this, just you can tell she's such a nice person while she's talking. And it was so interesting to hear her tips and advice and stuff like that. It really, really helped me along, because let's face it, there's not a whole lot of really good information out there. There's a lot of information, but not all of it's good. So tell me a little bit of Fiona Broom and how you're connected with her.
That's a wonderful question. And I absolutely adore Fiona Broom. And she is absolutely one of the reasons why I got back into paranormal investigation, and she is also responsible for some of our methodology. Even though we've developed a lot of our own, it was her book entitled Ghost Hunting in Haunted Cemeteries that really gave me some direction because, you know, as I said in the beginning of the interview, I started back in the late 80s and early 90s and then took a couple decades off. So when I got back into it, I really didn't know what to do. So that was the only resource I picked up, and I read it. I reread it. I must have read it, honestly, four or five times. And I was just enthralled with her perspective. So when I wrote the book and realizing how influential she was, I wrote to her. And I said, look, I said, I'm a big fan. I said, I absolutely love your work. I have 101 ghost hunting questions answered, ghost hunting in haunted cemeteries. I basically have all of your work. You know, would you be interested in writing a forward to my book if I sent you a copy? And I sensed that maybe she was a little hesitant at first, but she said, you know, sure, send me the copy. She got the copy, read it, and then all of a sudden I got this email, glowing email. She said, I could not put your book down. It's amazing. You have a perspective, a refreshing outlook on paranormal investigation that I've never seen before, and I'd be absolutely happy to write a foreword for this book. And since then, we've become really good friends.
Man, small world. And really, the paranormal world is not that big when it comes to investigators. There's only like a million of us, and that's not that many.
It's true. It's so true.
I just you know, if you're talking to her, let her know that she helped a very, very green EVP researcher feel a little less alone about 6 years ago, and she'll know exactly what you're talking about. And tell her I said, P.S., you're absolutely right. There's something about the statues. Absolutely right. And she'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Moving on. You know, we got this beautiful book. I'm hoping all my listeners are going to take it a chance and download this thing. Where can they find it to?
They could find it just about anywhere right now, but I would say the primary outlet would be Amazon. It's available both in soft cover and on Kindle. It could also be had through www.familyspiritsbook.com. That's the publisher website. They can order it directly through there as well.
Don't worry, gang. I'll make sure all these things are actually down in the show notes so we can give Bobby and his family a chance to promote that book and get it out there to you. So now the book is wrote. You're on this tour, really, across paranormal world of podcasting. You're going to be on every single show, and rightfully so. You got a wonderful voice and outlook and positive attitude. I think that's great. What's next, though, for the family spirit seekers here? Like, what's happening? What's the next step?
Well, this coming Friday, we have a really large book signing. It's we're almost at capacity, from what I understand, in the venue. And we're going to be doing a public ghost hunt after that. And that's going to be our very first. And that's at Old Lafayette Village in Lafayette, New Jersey, in the United States. And that's going to be a first because there's a lot of people that want a ghost hunt with us. So that and we have access to a very active old cemetery right across the street from the book signing venue. So that's going to be kind of fun. And I also right now have a comeback episode in production. We did an investigation looking for the spirit of, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you know, president of the United States around World War II, had a mistress, and she was buried in this one cemetery that I actually stumbled upon. And we went to get a communication there, but ended up dealing with an entity who wanted to play games with our equipment the entire time. So we have all of that on video, and that's going to be coming very, very soon.
Wow, that sounds exciting stuff, man. I love it. I can't get enough of this stuff. It's so refreshing to hear from somebody who's still into this stuff and getting out of it and then getting back into it. I mean, it's exciting for me because I recently got out of it and now I'm focusing on the podcast. You know what I mean? So it's good to know that, you know, a couple of decades from now, I can pick up the recorder just like Bobby J. Gallo and do it and get at this again. You know, to just kind of head back just one last time. Have you ever been to anywhere like Gettysburg or anything like that?
Oh my goodness. We've absolutely been to Gettysburg. In fact, we have a 3-part, We have three episodes. It was one investigation in three parts with the Ghost Gals, who are a paranormal group in Gettysburg, and they work exclusively pretty much in that area. And we did a joint investigation. And, you know, one of the episodes of one of the is called Girls in the Dark. It's very funny because we did a nighttime investigation with them, and we got some great evidence that day. They were really fun to work with. Gettysburg is absolutely amazing, but I'll be quite frank. I think probably the most evidence we've actually gathered in a military location was Antietam Battlefield, because if you know anything about Antietam in the American Civil War, that was actually the single bloodiest day in the American Civil War. About 50,000 people died in one day. Wow. So they were just throwing men at each other like cattle on the fields. And we were in the old church that was right on the battlefield. We got footsteps walking across the floor right in front of us. We have that on tape. We heard the phantom gunfire out in the fields. We got that on tape. And then we actually had a ghost of a fallen soldier asking us to contact a man named Paul Lee, which to this day we're still trying to figure that one out. It's just really, really amazing stuff. But yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, we've been to Gettysburg, Antietam, Kings Mountain, Battlefield, many, and actually even a lot of smaller battlefields as well.
Got to throw this out to you. Someone who's investigated a lot of military stuff, always consider a name reversed. So his name is Paul Lee. Have you looked up Lee Paul yet? Because sometimes soldiers go by their last name.
Oh, you know, I haven't done that.
You got to try that out, man. You got to try that out.
We may be revisiting this investigation because of you.
Listen, you got to come back. You know, you want to come north, so to speak. You ever want to come to Newfoundland and you ever want to come investigate just one of the most haunted places I've ever been in. I've done 20 investigations there, actually. A little place called Cape Spear. You're more than welcome to come, and I'll be sure to have hot cocoa ready to go for the girls.
And they would love that.
And the wife, tell her I said she's ghost bait. And Bobby, wonderful talking to you tonight. Thank you so much for being a guest on the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Guys, my guest tonight, Bobby J. Gallo, got to check out his book, Family Spirits, The Adventures and Evidence of Gallo Family Ghost Hunters. Check it out. It is full of just amazing evidence and information. There's actually a lot of info in there about different pieces of equipment and stuff that I really found was interesting. Just a different perspective on stuff. All the stuff is down in the show notes, of course. You know, if you want to check out the book, you want to check out the websites. Bobby, you have yourself a great evening.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the time to say goodbye is upon us. But don't worry, you can keep track of the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast very easily. It's available on Stitcher, iTunes, Podbean, and TuneIn Radio. Just look for the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast banner. Of course, if you'd like to keep up to date, you can always check out the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast Facebook page, drop a like, and every single time a new show goes up, you'll be notified. You can also follow me, John Mallard, on Twitter, at O-D-D-T-O-N-F-L-D. That's Odd to Newfoundland. From the oldest city in North America, I bid you adieu from the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast.